So Timothy Patrick McCarthy is an award-winning historian, educator, and human rights advocate, activist who has taught on the faculty at Harvard University since 2005. He currently holds a joint appointment in the Graduate School of Education and the John F. Kennedy School of Government, where he is core faculty at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. He's also Academic Director Emeritus and now Stanley Patterson Professor of American History in the Boston Clemente Course, a free college course for lower income adults, and a co-recipient of the 2015 National Humanities Medal. The adopted only son and grandson of public school teachers and factory workers, Dr. McCarthy graduated with honors from Harvard College and earned his MA, MPhil, and PhD in history from Columbia University. A noted scholar of politics and social movements, he is the author or editor of 6 books, including the forthcoming Stonewall's Children, Living Queer History in an Age of Liberation, Loss, and Love. Great title, Tim. And Reckoning with History, Unfinished Stories of American Freedom. He is also a frequent media commentator whose work has been featured in Salem, Huffington Post, The Daily Beast, Panjairus, The Nation, NPR, Al Jazeera, and several documentary films, including A Reckoning in Boston, which will be released this winter from Lost Nation Films. In June 2019, he was guest editor for the nation's historic Reclaiming Stonewall 50 Forum. Twice named one of Harvard's Crimson's Professors of the Year, Dr. McCarthy has received many awards for his commitment to students, including the 2015 Dean's Award for Exceptional Leadership on Diversity and Inclusion, and the 2019 Manuel C. Cavalli Award, the Kennedy School's highest teaching honor. In May 2020, amidst the COVID pandemic, Kennedy School graduates selected him to deliver a faculty address, Precedented Bravery, at their virtual class day ceremony. He's inspired by the activism and organizing of his student years. Dr. McCarthy has devoted his life to public service and social justice. He was a founding member of Barack Obama's National LGBT Leadership Council, part of the first ever LGBTQ delegation from the United States to Israel-Palestine, and currently serves as board chair for Free the Slaves, a leading global NGO in the fight to end modern slavery. He also hosts and directs ART of Human Rights and Resistance Mike through the Tony Award-winning American Repertory Theater, where he serves on the board of directors. And on top of all of that, he is most beloved by Women Explore. He's been with us many times. We learned from you, Tim. We're inspired by you. We're grateful for the work you do in the world. And the stage is yours for the next hour, and then we'll open it up for discussion. Yes. Oh, can we have your permission to record?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. And do you want questions in the form of people raising their hands, or do you want them to use the chat?
Raising hands is fine.
Raises hands. Okay. You got it.
Yeah.
Okay. It's all yours.
Thank you so much. And I appreciated that. I'm sorry I came a little bit late. I was coming from a meeting with students. I find myself on Zoom all the time now with students and I just joining. But I really found that conversation that you were having with your son to be really fascinating. And I think those are the kinds of conversations and encounters that that are tough but make us stronger in some ways. And certainly we learn from each other. So thank you for that
offer. Very precious to me, those opportunities. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for that offering it. I'm going to talk a little bit about those kinds of conversations today. Hi, everybody. It's great to see you all. It's so many familiar faces from all these years together. I also wanted to say how much I appreciate all of you and this group and what you do in the world, and never more so than now, honestly. I find myself craving these opportunities to be with people who are familiar and familial, and trying to find ways in this really, really extraordinary moment in history, not just in our little history, but in the nation's history and the world's history, finding ways to connect and to build community, but also to sustain community through all of this in a way that is really, really important. I don't think I need to tell any of you how important it is to try to figure out how we can sustain what has been something we rely on through this very, very, very disrupted time, hoping that when we get on the other side of this, that those things will still be there. So sustaining them here is important. So thank you, Barb, for inviting me and inviting me back and having me here. So this is a really weird time to talk about patriotism. I'm just gonna put that out there at the very beginning. I mean, I always find it a weird time to talk about patriotism, given my particular lived experience in the world and what I do and how I do it. But wow, we're in the middle of an election. Election day is coming 12 days from now, but we're already in the middle of this. We're in the middle of so many things. And when I think about patriotism, it's interesting because you know, I used to have a car. I no longer have a car because we're trying to be better global citizens with respect to the environment. So we got rid of our car, my husband and I, a couple of years ago. But we had a bumper sticker that said, "Dissent is patriotic." You know, one of those things. I'm sure I have a T-shirt and a button and all sorts of other things. And I believe that, right? That dissent is patriotic. And yet I find myself, and it's interesting, Michael, was it Michael, your son?
Yes.
Michael. Michael said, you know, when he travels abroad, he doesn't want to be the ugly American, right? He wants to represent the country in a particular way. And last Monday, I did an event with the Harvard Club of Ireland. That invited me to come, you know, give a talk, and they asked me to talk about the 2020 election. And one of the things that created a little bit of anxiety when I was going into that chat, and it was, you know, several hundred people on this call, was I felt like I had to kind of explain the country, but also like represent it. And, you know, and I had, you know, I've been at Timothy Patrick McCarthy. This wasn't my first time with Irish people. And but usually I go to Ireland and I'm there. And I really did feel like this strange burden about, you know, not only, you know, representing what I have as a critique of this moment and where we are, how we got here, where we might go, but I also did really feel a little bit defensive about the country. Not defending anything that's happening here, but feeling defensive about wanting it to get better. And that was a little bit strange for me, because I felt a defensiveness that I usually don't feel. And it was only in this prospect of talking to people who are outside of the country, with whom I had some connection, obviously, by heritage and also by affection, that I love Ireland probably more than I love America in some ways, and we can get into that. But I did feel a kind of burden of representation that I had not felt in a while. And so, you know, and yet at the same time, I want like literally almost everything about America right now to change. Like there's like almost nothing that I'm looking at. I'm like, oh yeah, this is good. No, like this is we're a hot mess, right? We're on a precarious precipice right now. And so You know, so I'm conflicted, and I, in preparing what I wanted to say to all of you, I felt this like need to kind of reconcile or to square that. And then at the same time, I'm kind of like, you know what? We are a mess and we've always been a mess. And that's the whole point of democracy. That's the whole point of an experiment in democracy that has frankly lasted for 2.5 centuries in different ways and may yet endure and also may perish. And, you know, we are a country that has tried something that is really unprecedented in the world in terms of both the democratic experiment and also the multicultural experiment of so many different kinds of people from all over the world who have tried to, you know, figure out how to make this work in terms of just living alongside one another, but also like having some felt sense that we're in this together in some way and in different ways. That's extraordinary. And I'm not an American exceptionalist by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think that there are things about this country that are unique, if not uncommon, that are worth noting and my deepest heart also worth fighting for. Democracy and multicultural democracy being at the forefront of that. And yet, when I hear the word patriotism, I bristle. And then I very rarely, even though I have that bumper sticker, "Dissent is patriotic," ever think about patriotism in a positive way. But when I think about patriotism, I think about it in two ways. One is the love of country, and the other way that I think about it is loyalty to country. Love and loyalty as parts of that word and part of that experience and feeling. And it is all those things. It's a word. It's just a word. And yet it is also an experience, and it's also a feeling, right? One of the reasons why we have so many fraught debates, right? You and your son have these fraught debates is because, like, we feel something when we think of America, or when we see the flag, or when we travel abroad and are identified as American, or all of these things. We feel something. It's affective and it's emotional. And yet both love and loyalty are not requirements for human existence. They're earned feelings and they're earned affinities and they're earned relationships, right? We're not born loving and we're not born loyal. That we choose who we love and we choose what we're loyal to. And that has to be earned, and it has to be earned on both sides. It's reciprocal in that way. And I've been thinking about this in terms of, one thing that this last year has done for me is it's thrown me deep back into my own training as a historian. And I've been reading a lot of the founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the constitutional debates and the Hamilton soundtrack and all of these things. I've also, as a couple of you probably know, I've been working with the American Repertory Theater's revival of 1776, the musical. And at the end of my chat today, I'm going to play you something that's not public yet. I'm going to give you a little insight into this. But I've been working with the cast, and the cast of I'm even though it was supposed to be at the theater debuting as a revival in the spring, it is still on hold, and they're waiting until at some point the theater comes back to launch this musical. But it was supposed to already be on its way to Broadway. And yet this has disrupted it. And it was scheduled by Diane Paulus and Jeffrey Page, who are co-directing the musical, to be timed to the election, right? It was supposed to sort of debut on Broadway in this moment leading up to the 2020 election. And it's the musical 1776 about the Declaration of Independence that won the Tony for Best Musical in 1969, in the middle of the tumult of the 1960s, in the end of the 1960s, at a moment here. So it was meant to like talk about 1776 and the 60s and 2020, and it was meant to kind of do all of that work. And I've been working with the cast. And the cat, when I characterize this play, this revival of the musical, I say it's Hamilton on steroids, because it has no one in the cast among the performers who are straight cisgender white men. Everyone in the cast is a person of color, and or a trans or queer person, and or a female identified person. So it's literally something, it's extraordinary. Ben Franklin is played by a gender queer female identified African American person, right? John Hancock is played by an African American woman who is a grandmother who does like an open mic, like arts performance at different bars in Dallas, Texas, right, who was part of an event I did last night. So it's extraordinary, extraordinary cast. But one of the things that we've been doing is going back to the root of and the founding of the country. And it was so funny because this group of people who were not in the imagination of the founding fathers have had to kind of return to 1776 and literally become the founding fathers. And so we've been reading these documents and we've been going back to the founding and we've been trying to think. And one of the through lines of our conversations over the last 6 or 7 months has been like, how do you develop an investment in your country when your country never imagined that you would be part of it? Or that if you were part of it, you would be deeply subordinated, never equal, never free, never deserving of the rights that they articulated from the very beginning. And yet, at the same time, we, all of us, and nobody on this call, most people on this call, were not imagined by the founding fathers. Right? None of us would have been at the Second Continental Congress. Like we would, I mean, I might have gotten in the front door and then they would have kicked me out once they figured out who I was. And yet, there is a kind of investment in the project of what that time produced. And I mean, going back to that about what love of country and what loyalty to country means in the context of a country that was literally born of an act of treason, of disloyalty, that produced something that now requires our love, that also at the time was forged with a very limited imagination about who among us would be included in this thing that we would then be expected to love and be loyal to. So I've been thinking a lot about that. And the other night, you mentioned the Clemente course. I teach and have taught for 20 years a course called the Clemente Course in the Humanities, which was born right after 9/11, started 2 weeks after 9/11 hit. And it's a college humanities course for lower income adults that's taught through the Codman Square Health Center in Dorchester. And so I've been the American history teacher and professor in that course for 20 years now. And I was the academic director. I ran the course for 10 years for the first decade of its existence. We decided in the middle of this to continue it, right? Just like Women Explore is continuing through COVID, we decided, all right, you know what? We can't give up on Clemente. We have to figure out a way. So we are now doing a kind of a public square on Zoom with folks who want to join. And on Tuesday, I had a group of about 30 people who were on Zoom who came together to talk about community and responsibility and what we owe each other, and we use the Declaration of Independence as a starting point. And one of the things that we talked about the other day was the yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia in 1793. And a lot of people, I asked the students, I said, you know, how many of you know about this? And two or three hands raised, and everybody else like, what are you talking about? Turns out that Philadelphia, which was the capital of the country in 1793 and was the largest city in the United States and also the city that had the highest percentage of African Americans living together with white people and the first city to have the first anti-slavery organization and a city that was robust in terms of its civic institutions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And over the summer of 1793, there was a yellow fever epidemic that spread in Philadelphia, and there was all of this tumult and so forth. But one of the things that happened was that there was a suspicion or a theory that black people were not susceptible to yellow fever, that they were immune from yellow fever. And so the city called all of these black people into service to be frontline essential workers in the middle of a yellow fever pandemic in Philadelphia. It turns out the black people were not immune, and they died in equal percentages to the white population of Philadelphia at the time. 5,000 of the 50,000 people who lived in Philadelphia died that year. It's still, in terms of percentage, in terms of percentages, one of the deadliest epidemics in the history, not only of the United States, of the world. Think about it. 10% of the population of the city died in the span of 6 months. So I've been thinking about these things, the Declaration of Independence, all of these promises, and then this yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia in 1793, which in some ways has deep resonance to the current day in terms of the racial inequities that the pandemic has exposed, the way that certain kinds of people are on the front lines as essential workers, the way in which people serve their country. And many of these African American folks who served as nurses to the sick and cadaver carriers and grave diggers for the dead, right, were called into service because they wanted to prove themselves worthy of citizenship, because they had a love for Philadelphia and their neighbors. And they also had a felt sense that the new nation was a place that was worth healing, was worth tending to. And you see this in the language of many of the folks whose testimonies we have available to us in history. And I'm thinking about that, right? That, like, in 1776, all of these, like, white founding fathers, many of whom were slaveholders, talked about all men are created equal, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. We need to commit treason to get away from the British Empire and to create this new nation that is going to be new in the world and dedicated to all of these things that the world has never, ever really committed to. And yet they committed themselves to that. And then literally less than 20 years later, you have this public health crisis that exposed all of the racism and the classism and all of the different inequalities that already existed in the country, literally less than 20 years later. So all men were not created equal, it turns out, right? And that was evident right away. And so I've been thinking a lot about the conflicted founding of the nation. What is it we love, and what is it that we're supposed to be loyal to? And who has loved it, and who has been loyal to it? And then I think about another kind of founding, which we're in the middle of a debate about, and Donald Trump made this kind of notorious a couple of weeks ago. Not Donald Trump, as some of you may have heard, hosted or presided over a White House conference on American history. And it turns out that there was only one formally trained historian who was actually invited to this convening. So I'm a historian, and I have a PhD in history, and I know a lot of historians, and no one I knew was invited to this White House convening on American history. And yet at that convening, Donald Trump name-checked in a denigrating way both Howard Zinn, my mentor, who has now passed away, also the reason why I'm talking to your group, because I substituted for him when he was sick at the end of his life, and that's how I came to all of you, was through Howard Zinn. So Donald Trump name checked and talked about Howard Zinn as an ideologue, as someone who is ruining the children, miseducating, and he also name checked the 1619 project in the New York Times, which is another project that seeks to think about a different kind of founding for the country 400 years ago in 1619, when the first boatload of enslaved people was brought to North America into Jamestown, Virginia, against their will. To labor with no rights, equality, or freedom. And I've been thinking about that too, right? As like, how can you love or be loyal to a country, right? That at the one hand in 1776 is saying all of these grandiose things and yet betrays that right at the very moment of the birth. And then also has 150 plus year history of violating all of those claims to begin with. And so how do you make sense of this? And so it's hard for me to think about how to love and be loyal to a country. And yet I come back to my favorite quote by James Baldwin, which is, "I love America," James Baldwin wrote, "more than any other country on earth. And precisely for that reason, I insist on the right to criticize her," and he genders the nation feminine, "perpetually. I love America more than any other country on earth, and precisely for that reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually." And I keep coming back to that. And I keep coming back to the country. And I keep coming back to the origin of the country as a conflicted and contested and contradictory idea and place. And I keep coming back to the fact that I still want to fight for it and feel that I need in some way to represent it and explain it, never more so than in this history. I suppose part of that has to do with the fact that I was raised by fierce women. I have two grandmothers, very, very different women. One was the oldest of 16 immigrant children. She ran away from home because my great-grandfather said that school was unnecessary for girls. And she ran away from home. She went to college, applied to college, and got accepted to college without anyone's knowledge. She established a P.O. box, and she wrote letters to all of her siblings because she was the oldest, and they all loved her. She also corresponded with her mother, my great-grandmother, but never with her father, my great-grandfather. She went off to college in upstate New York. She started the women's athletic program at Plattsburgh State, which is now Plattsburgh State. Then she moved to New York, and she became a public school teacher, and she taught for 50 years as a public school teacher. She was a teacher union president. She worked with Dorothy Day in the Catholic worker homes in New York City, and she was a trailblazing educator and activist, and she was a civil rights pioneer and so forth and so on. So she was a trailblazer in education and civil rights and women's rights and labor rights and all of these things. And she retired from teaching the year that I was born, the year that I was adopted by my parents. I was abandoned on the stoop of a Catholic charities agency in June of 1971, and my grandmother had retired that year, so she moved upstate from New York to Albany, where I grew up, and she was the one who raised me, because my mom and dad both were teachers as well, and they taught full-time. My grandmother was the one who kept asking me questions. Every time I would come home, right, I remember this, I pledged allegiance to the flag the first day of kindergarten, and she said, "What did that feel like for you?" I was like, "I don't know, I was five." I was like, I did what everybody else did. And she said, "Why?" And we had that conversation, and every single day and every single weekend as I grew older, she and I would spend time together, and she would always ask me what I learned, what I did in school, and then she would always ask me what I had questions about. Because she didn't want me to accept any kind of truth. And so I was raised with that kind of criticality in mind, and she was the one who raised me to be that way. My other grandmother was a factory worker who dropped out of high school in ninth grade. And while I was in high school, she was studying for her GED. So we would study together on the weekends. And so I would go from one grandmother's house to the other. My one grandmother, trailblazing educator, first gen, everything, would be like, you need to ask questions about your education. The other grandmother would say, you need to get an education, you need to value an education, because this is the way that you move up in society. And yet at the same time, you have to understand that education is something that helps you participate more fully in the country that you don't yet fully belong to. And so I had these two profound women and two profound influences on my life. And they both are, if I could get into my office at the Kennedy School, I have my one grandmother's proclamation from the mayor when she was, when she retired, they named the street to her school after her. And so there's a proclamation from the mayor, and I have the picture of her as the captain of the women's basketball team at Plattsburgh State on my wall in my office. And then on the other wall, right next to it in my office, instead of my PhD, which I buried with my grandmother when she passed away, I have her GED. So there's the proclamation from the trailblazer and the GED from the other trailblazer, my two grandmothers, and it sits over me in my office at Kennedy School, and every student who comes into that office has to listen to my story about my two grandmothers. They taught me a lot about the country, what to love about it, how to become fully part of it, how to ask questions about it, and that was how I grew up. It's no surprise then that I loved history and that I fell in love with history and I wanted to learn more about history, not just because my grandparents and my parents were great storytellers and I listened to all their stories all the time at every family occasion, but because they instilled in me a desire to love stories. History and literature, which are the two things that I studied in college and then went on to study in graduate school and now teach back here as well. And I started to understand that that history, which is basically a study of change over time, often omits different kinds of people and also conveys a particular kind of story. And that there are a lot of people that are left out of that, including most of my family. And so as I started to discover history and started to love history, I started to realize that we get told history from the perspective of the people who are powerful, who leave records, right? Who think they're important and therefore leave the breadcrumb trail that we can tell their stories most powerfully, right? The captains of industry and the presidents and the generals and da, 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 da. And it turns out that most of those people are men. Most of those people are in American history are white. Most of those people are elites and they're wealthy and so forth, as if they're the only ones who make history. And I started to realize, like, where is everybody else? And so as I started to study history, because of the history of my family that I grew up in, I started to ask questions about the country. Like, why is it the way we study the country and the way we understand the country is through a particular story that leaves everybody in the country out of it? And that's where I discovered Howard Zinn and other people who were interested in telling a people's history. A more inclusive history, a history from the bottom up, that allowed us to understand that women and queer people and black people and enslaved people and workers and all of these other people were also engines of history, that they had a place in this. And it relates to this idea about patriotism, because I'm like, how can you love a country that you don't see yourself in? How loyal to a country that when it tells its story about itself, excludes you from being even minor or supporting characters? Like, how are you supposed to love or be loyal to something that excludes you? And one of the reasons why the country, the story of the country is so often told in the most limited and narrow ways is precisely because the lives and lived experiences of all of us and so many of the people who are left out of those stories are left out because their lived experiences are on the downside of discrimination, on the other side of equality and normal, in a way that really makes it complicated to make a clear and easy articulation of freedom. That if the country sees itself as a place of freedom and equality and rights and all of these things that we should be proud of, then how do you tell the story of all the people that don't enjoy those things and don't have those things? So you just get rid of them when you tell the story, because it's too complicated to tell the story with all of them as part of it. And so when I started to realize all of that, and it turns out that I was being raised to understand all of that because I was from this family that was, in a sense, written out of the histories that I had been told and that I had been taught, that I now was trying to figure out how to study, write, teach, etc. So that's what set me flowing. And then as I got older, as I became an adult, things got even more complicated, because not history for me at that moment was something, as I came of age, became something that I was living, not just studying. I graduated from high school in June of 1989 when the tanks rolled into Tiananmen Square. My first year of college at Harvard, the wall in Berlin was torn down. The fall of my sophomore year, America went to war in Iraq. The spring of my sophomore year, Nelson Mandela walked out of Robben Island prison. My junior year, the Soviet Union dissolved in Moscow, the race riots broke out in Los Angeles, and the fall of my senior year, Bill Clinton was elected president of the United States, ending the long Reagan and Bush era, or at least we thought. So I came of age, and all of that was layered on top of course, the AIDS crisis, which became very important to me as someone who was at that point in the closet and then would come out as gay and queer. So I came of age at a world historical time when things were swirling, and that was when I developed this intellectual investment in history, having been raised by all of these sort of history makers that were not part of that narrative. And so I tried to figure out, like, how do I make sense of where I am in all of this, understanding that this is happening all around us. My advisor in graduate school, Eric Fonaroy, says that historians write and teach and live their lives with one eye on the past and one eye on the present. And that's what kind of inspires us to do the work that we do. And so when it comes to telling the story of the country and being loving or loyal to the country, I think about some crucial pieces that have shaped who I am. One is that when I was in graduate school and really doubting whether or not I wanted to get a PhD, I read a series of articles about these church burnings that were being white people burning black churches all over the South. And I was like, what's going on there? Like, that sounds like the 50s and 60s. Like, why is this happening now? It turns out that there was a wave of black church burnings. There were 1,000 black churches that were burned in the United States in the 1990s, 1,000. And so I started in the middle of the 1990s going on these trips that I then ultimately led and brought students down south to rebuild these black churches that were burned to the ground by white supremacists during the 1990s and then ultimately in the 2000s. I spent 15 years doing this and took 400 students from Harvard and Columbia and North Carolina, where I spent 2 years, down south to rebuild these churches. And I remember thinking, while I was studying the civil rights movement and the abolitionist movement and Reconstruction and the Civil War, I was trying to rebuild black churches that were burned down. And the connection between that past and that present became very, very urgent for me. And I thought about, and that was at a point where I had become more progressive, I was becoming more radical, I actually started to hate the country. And then I would go to these services in these black churches all over the South, and they would pray for the president. and they would pray for the country. And they would talk about rights, and they would talk about freedom, and they would talk about equality, and they would talk about the promised land, and they would talk about all of these things that I couldn't even imagine. And there was, in this way, a deep faith, rooted in some cases in their religious faith, but a deep secular faith in what the country could become and what it said it was at the very beginning. Nicole Hannah Jones, in her introductory essay for the 1619 Project, says that democracy and freedom and equality only mean something in America because Black people have always believed in those original promises, yet unrealized, but still important to struggle for. And then that Black freedom struggle has been at the core of the country, and the country would have perished long ago if it hadn't been for that. And I remember thinking, as a white person who became a radical and was like really critical of my country, I started to realize, maybe there's something to this. Maybe I need to follow their lead and learn from them and understand that. And then 9/11 happened. I've talked about this to this group before. And shortly after 9/11, I appeared at a rally at Widener Library at Harvard in the yard, and I said some things. I'm not quite sure what I said. And then turns out a couple weeks later, I was blacklisted by Lynn Cheney, who was the second lady of the country. So Lynn Cheney had a group that was basically a campus watch group that she had founded, and they were on the lookout for academics in the country who were what they called blame America first, or the hate America first crowd. And I became one of those people, Howard Zinn, others, Noam Chomsky, Angela Davis, a bunch of people. And all of my graduate mentors, as it turns out, at Columbia. So I was in good company. But I was young. I was 30 years old. And I was called short on patriotism and a threat to homeland security during a time of war, right on the eve of the launch of the war in Afghanistan and then 2 years before the war in Iraq. And all of a sudden, I was deemed unpatriotic, short on patriotism, a threat, a national security threat. That was the language they used. And I didn't even know what any of that meant. I was literally getting a PhD in American history called Unpatriotic and a Threat to Homeland Security. And I was trying to figure out how to wrap my head around that. And so instead of falling silent or diving into my own insecurities, I decided to lean in because I really felt in my bones, for whatever the reason, partly because I had been raised properly by my folks and my grandmother was a pacifist and an anti-war activist and a peace person. And I was right. Not like me, I was right, but like these wars were unjust. That the vengeance project that I felt they represented were not what I wanted my country to be. And so I leaned in and I got into some trouble and I had to leave Harvard for a bit. That's why I went to North Carolina. And I really did a bunch of reflection about what it means to be a peace person in a nation where patriotism is often oriented around war. Is it possible for someone like me to love my country or be loyal to my country if I hate what my country is doing to other countries? Is that even possible? And to your conversation with your son, Michael, one of the things that reinforced my own sensibilities about peace, ability to find a way back to my country, was through a bunch of guys, all men, who were coming and going from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Turns out Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which is where I was living for 2 years, is right near Fort Bragg. And it turns out that the 82nd Airborne is at Fort Bragg. And it turns out that that was the highest traffic military base in the country during Iraq and Afghanistan. And it turns out that I got a job as a bouncer and a bartender at a bar where all of those guys who were coming and going came to get drunk and sometimes hook up. More often than not, they didn't get lucky, as they used to call it, but they would stay afterwards and we would go in the back and we would drink after hours and they would talk about what it meant to go to war. And what I realized in those conversations and what I found out in those very late nights is that many, many of them had the same feelings about these wars that I had. But they had these feelings from the front lines. Some of them also thought these wars were just. And we got into those arguments and we got into those fights. And sometimes those were uncomfortable and we shouted at each other. And sometimes we had to step away. We never came to any kind of fisticuffs over it. But there was one night where it almost happened, where they had brought a member of their crew who had done two tours in Iraq and had gone through the reentry protocols, and it was his first night out, and he was very, very drunk. And at one point, I made some comment. It was in the middle of the 2004 election, and I talked about how much I was hoping that John Kerry would beat George W. Bush in the election. And he said, "Oh, why do you, you know," he got in my face about John Kerry, and he called him many names, and they called me some names, and they were unsavory, and some of them referred to female genitalia, some of them referred to my sexual orientation, and he got in my face, and I thought there was going to be a fight. And then one of the military guys, who had done three tours by this point, 2004, had already done three tours in Afghanistan and Iraq, got in between us and said, "You may disagree with him, but if we're fighting these wars, we're fighting these wars so that he has the freedom to say what he is saying. And if you don't respect what he's saying, even though you disagree with it, then I don't know what we're doing. And I don't know what we're doing in this military to begin with." And this friend of mine got between us and stopped that fight. And even though my friend and I had gotten into many debates and disagreements about this, he thought Afghanistan was just and Iraq was not. And we had that fight. But it was those folks who were at war for the country after 9/11, in which I was called unpatriotic and a threat to homeland security, that I learned the complexity about what it means to love the country and to be loyal to the country. And that we had different ways of thinking about that. And yet, if we hadn't met each other, we wouldn't have known that. And that the country and what it means to be patriotic can, in a sense, contain multitudes. Walt Whitman, in his famous Leaves of Grass, says, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes." And I love that, because I do think that that's a way of thinking about the country. And when I think about the country, I think about it also from the perspective of the fact that I am a gay person. I am a queer man. I am now married for the time being. We'll see how things go. And I've been on the downside of discrimination. There's nobody on this Zoom call that hasn't been on the downside of discrimination in a country that claims to be free and equal and full of rights. Anybody who has been on the downside of discrimination, on the other side of normal, and the outside of equality, understands what it means to be tortured when it comes to love or loyalty with respect to one's country. And yet, we're still here. And when I think about this moment, and I said this last night, and I will close on this, we're in the middle of a mess right now. I really do think that we're on the precipice of something. We're either on the precipice of a portal to a different kind of country and world, which could be so much bigger and braver and more wonderful than what we have now, which is none of those things. Or we stand on the precipice of the end of things, the end of America and the end of democracy. And it's been a good run. For a long time, 250 years almost. And yet, we have three choices. We can flee, we can go, and I've certainly thought about getting my Irish citizenship, so I can flee and get the hell out of here, depending on what happens in the next couple of weeks. We can freeze and not know what to do, or we can fight. We can fight for this thing, and I think about that, like, why do I want to fight still? And it's because I love something about this place still. And it's not just the place and the people, it's the idea of it all. It's those bold claims about a new world that was born of treason and forged in contradiction. And 250 years later, I still think, as unpatriotic as Lynn Cheney thinks I am, that those things are worth fighting for and worth saving if we can. And so I go back to Baldwin. I love America more than any other country on earth, and precisely for that reason, I insist on the right to criticize her, him, it, perpetually. And it's that perpetual criticism that's the thing I love. Because the perpetual criticism was the thing that gave birth to the nation in the first place. And it's the first amendment to the Constitution, which, thank God, still exists. And the first amendment of the Constitution that is forged in that crucible of dissent is the thing that has allowed us to survive so far to this place and in this very, very, very difficult moment. And so do I love my country? I love what my country can be. I love what my country says it wants to be. Am I loyal to it? I'm loyal to the principles, and I'm loyal to the people. And I'm loyal to whatever exists on the other side of that portal to a new world. Because we were forged in a radical world historical moment where a new world could be imagined. And 250 years later, we need to do that again. Because it's the only thing that will let us keep on and to carry on, which is what my late great mentor Howard Zinn said to me, the last two words he said to me before he died, 3 weeks before he died. We were in a theater. And he said, I'm not feeling well, I'm going to go home. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, carry on. It's the only option. Woo! So I want to show you this. And then we can chat about everything, but can I share my screen? Yes. I'm going to show you something that is, it's a little bit of a debut. Those of you who were at, Resistance Mic last night will understand this. This is a song from the forthcoming revival of 1776, the musical. This is not for public consumption. This is something that's very private, but I'm sharing it with you. And the woman who is singing at first is John Adams. She's a Broadway star, Crystal Lucas Perry, and some of you may know her. She'll probably get nominated for Tony for playing John Adams. And then there's a remix of this song that a whole bunch of other members of the cast are in. But I wanted to close with this because I think it speaks both to the experience of figuring out how we can understand and reckon with our history, but it also speaks to how we claim the audacity of love and loyalty to a place that may not have yet reciprocated that. So here is anybody there?